Welcome everyone. I'm the introduction person, the chair, I see I am. Kate McMillan's my name. I'm in charge of the probate list over at the Supreme Court. So I get to see the other end of what you're doing at the during the week. It's a great pleasure to be here to introduce the speakers this morning. Originally we were three people. We have Peter Pascoe, Jeremy Smith, and we did have Simon Pitt, but unfortunately he's had to pull out due to family reasons. So it would be Peter and Jeremy. Now, you probably all know Peter and Jeremy. They've been around for some time, like me, and you also will know of their reputation as quality advocates. Peter has been around since, at the bar anyway, since 1988, and is a specialist in this area. Jeremy came to the bar a little bit later, and each of them do a lot of work in this jurisdiction. I have had the pleasure of working with them and against them when I was at the bar, and now I have the undoubted pleasure of having them appear before me. And on all occasions, they have always been well prepared and push hard for their clients, but know when to pull back. And I commend them to you. If you want to see a good example of drafting, just go straight to Peter Pascoe. He has an ability, in my view, to no other, to be able to tell the story that's involved in the case that he's doing in a succinct way and clear. So I am particularly admiring of his drafting ability. Jeremy and I were opposed in a case some years ago, and it was a, like all of these wills cases and type cases, an undue influence case, and it was hard fought, but throughout it all, we fought hard for our clients, but we always were able to maintain a professional relationship and respect each other in the way we ran the case. The first speaker is Jeremy, and he's going to talk about summary judgment applications. So I'll pass you over to Jeremy.
Well, thank you, Your Honour, for those generous remarks, and thank you all for turning up so early. I've prepared a paper which has been handed out, and I'm not going to go through everything that's in it because the time doesn't really permit us to do that. But it's an interesting point at which to revisit a sequence of summary judgment applications in Part 4 claims. And the reason it's interesting is because there's a recent decision by the Court of Appeal concerning summary judgment more broadly, and the true meaning of Section 63 of the Civil Procedure Act. Now, you'll all be very familiar with the fact that forever and a day you've been able to apply for summary judgment pursuant to the rules. And you can now, since the enactment of the Civil Procedure Act, you can now apply pursuant to Section 63. If I can refer to the rules and the old test, if you like, essentially you were arguing that a claim didn't disclose a cause of action, alternatively that there was a good defence to a claim on the merits, and the question was, well, what standard does the court apply? And it was very well established in a sequence of High Court cases. And I've listed a couple of those in paragraph 2. General Steele is the case most frequently referred to. And essentially, judgment's only given where a claim was hopeless or bound to fail. And everyone's familiar with that test. It's been the test for a very long time, and it's been revisited time and again. The Civil Procedure Act was interesting because it appeared on the face of it to introduce a less stringent test. And what I mean by less stringent is that it appeared to make it easier to obtain summary judgment and dismiss an unmeritorious claim. Now, I've set out the terms of section 63 at paragraph 3, and the test is that a claim, the defendant in applying to dismiss the plaintiff's claim needs to demonstrate that the claim has no real prospect of success. Now, compare that with the old test, hopeless or bound to fail. What's the difference? The High Court dealt with this question to some extent in 2010 in Spencer and Commonwealth. And in that case, which I've referred to in paragraph 3, the court accepted what had become the accepted wisdom, if you like, that what no real prospect of success meant was that a case had to have a real rather than a fanciful prospect of success. But if you read that judgment, and I should say in that case the court was considering a slightly different expression, no reasonable prospect of success rather than what we deal with, no real prospect. When you read that decision, you have the impression that, notwithstanding what the court says, that the court is not entirely convinced that there's a great deal of difference between the new test and the old. Now, there were then a sequence in the Supreme Court in this state, a sequence of judgments, and I've referred to two of them. One, a judgment of Justice Dixon in Otedon, and of Justice Jack Forrest in Matthews and SPI Electricity. And you'll see there, I've extracted the parts of the judgment that really go to this question about the meaning of the new test. And Justice Dixon very helpfully set out in point form those 6 points there, and that he observed that a claim which should be dismissed under the old test will be dismissed under the new test, obviously. And then he says at point two, section 63 is less stringent, and what is required is a practical judgment by the court as to whether a claim has more than a fanciful prospect of success. You can read the rest of those at your leisure, but His Honour's really stated the law as it stands and the law as it is frequently expressed. His Honour Justice Forrest similarly provides a short and punchy summary of the law. He also says at point three, which I think is interesting, the less complex the issue in a case, the easier it is for a court to take the view that such a proceeding is capable of being determined on summary judgment. Perhaps that goes without saying, but I think all of these remarks are helpful when you're turning your mind to whether a claim perhaps can be the subject of a successful application. So there's the accepted wisdom about what the test means. However, last year in the Court of Appeal, and I've referred to this in paragraph 7, there was a case called Karam and Palmoni Shoes, and there was a judgment in that case of Their Honours Justices of Appeal Nettle and Osborne, and the case came before the Court of Appeal. It was a rather torturous sequence of litigation, and it arose by reason of an application by an enthusiastic plaintiff in the magistrate's court to have a defence struck out. He was unsuccessful, he appealed, and Her Honour Associate Justice Daly dismissed the appeal on pursuant to a section 63 application by the defendant. So Her Honour exercised that power and knocked it out. Now, ultimately it worked its way through to the Court of Appeal where Their Honours dealt with it, and they were very focused on trying to track this, as I said, torturous sequence of litigation. They then came to a discussion, a very short discussion of section 63 and what it really means. And I've extracted the relevant part there on page 4. They say the change in terms was not intended to establish a new or different test, rather to express more accurately the way in which the rule had been interpreted by the courts. And they say the power to order a summary judgment is to be exercised sparingly and not unless it's clear that there's no real question to be tried. So essentially, Justices Nettle and Osborne are saying there's no difference. That, I think, perhaps caused some confusion, and a question of law was then referred to the Court of Appeal, this question of law, and it was dealt with in a recent decision earlier this year, which is Lysaart Building Solutions, and I refer to this at paragraph 8. And in that that decision, Chief Justice Warren and Justice of Appeal Nettle go through in very thorough fashion the Law Reform Commission report that led to these changes, the various decisions that are relevant in other jurisdictions, and what's interesting is they look at the Law Reform Commission report and say, well, hang on, here's what it said. It said the objective here is to liberalise the test. The procedure should be used more frequently and flexibly to deal with claims that are unmeritorious. The court noted the English reforms, where this had originated. The court looked at the general steel test, the hopeless bound to fail test, and said, well, what is the difference? That is to say, can a claim that would have survived under the old test perish under the new test? And Their Honour said, it is difficult to conceive of such a case. They said, it's hard to envisage circumstances in which there could be any difference between what's needed to demonstrate one or the other. And however, they say at paragraph 29, the law is at present understood, the way the law is at present understood, the real chance of success test, so that's the new test, permits of the possibility that there may be cases yet to be identified in which it appears that although respondent's case is not hopeless or bound to fail, it doesn't have a real prospect of success. So Their Honours are saying there might be a case where you get a different result depending on which test, but such a case is yet to be identified. So it's a bit like the thylacine. It could be out there, but no one's seen it. Now, the court then came to the preceding judgment in Carrum and said, yes, there may have been some misunderstanding of what we meant there, or rather what Justices Nettle and Osborne meant there. And Their Honours explained that by saying it was an endeavour to emphasise that there appears to be little distinction in practical effect between the general steel test and the new test. Now, that's by way of background, really, to the topic today, which is focused on the application of these principles to Part 4 claims. But I think it's important to turn one's mind to the test at the outset and how it's viewed. I should say, and Simon Pitt's not here this morning, he's an apology, but Simon pointed me also in that judgment to some comments at the end by Her Honour Justice of Appeal Neave. Now, I read the plurality judgment. Justice Neave agreed, but she wrote a very short, separate judgment. And it is worth having a look at Her Honour's comments, because she said she agreed with Justices Nettle and the Chief Justice, and she said she referred in more detail to the Law Reform Commission report and its objectives. She said the Law Reform Commission was hoping to provoke a change in attitude and make parties more inclined to seek summary judgment and courts more prepared to grant them. So she put that up front, and she then said she agreed with the Chief Justice and Justice Nettle about the need for caution in such applications, and the courts are always saying you have to be very cautious about these applications. She said, nevertheless, I'm concerned that undue emphasis on caution runs the risk of reinforcing the historical approach to summary dismissal and may result in the legislative liberalisation of the test having little impact. That approach would be inconsistent with the objective of reforming the law relating to summary judgment expressed in the Civil Procedure Act, and with the requirement that the court give effect to the overarching purposes of the Act. So, Her Honour took the trouble to write that those additional comments because the court really is saying there's no change, nothing to see here, but at the same time Parliament has made it very clear that this is intended to be a more liberal test. So if you are running an application, I'd be taking the court to those comments by Her Honour Justice of Appeal Neave and reminding the court that this is in fact intended to be a more liberal test. Which brings us to the Part 4 cases. Now, I've summarised the cases that I'm aware of in this paper. It starts really at paragraph 18 with Harris and Bennett back in 2002. That was a claim by a grandchild who had never met his grandfather, had nothing to do with his grandfather. There was indeed a great deal of debate about whether the grandfather knew this boy was in fact his grandchild. Master Evans upheld a summary dismissal claim. Justice MacDonald on appeal reversed that decision and said, no, this matter should go to trial. Now, notwithstanding the breadth of or the significance of the changes to the Act in 1998, there were no more summary judgment applications, as far as I can tell, until 2011. So it seemed that that decision of Justice MacDonald resonated in a way that served to warn people off making such claims. In any event, in 2011 there was a decision in Jackson and Nunes, and I presume a lot of you are familiar with that judgment. It's worth reading. It's a very thorough judgment of Associate Justice Mukhtar, 65-year-old nephew, estate of about $1 million. He got $250,000 under the will, so he didn't get nothing. The farm, which was the main asset, went to a cousin. He had a very close relationship with the uncle as a child. He maintained the relationship as an adult. He used to go up there and stay with the uncle, work on the farm, that sort of thing. As he got older, he became a pharmacist. As he got older, things, his luck changed a bit, and he, I think he may have had a separation and certainly wasn't a wealthy person. But the relationship really with his uncle fell away, to the point where he would ring the uncle several times a year, but that was about it. And His Honour upheld the application to dismiss the claim. He said that, yes, summary dismissal in that such applications as these are rare, and rare with good reason, but there's only one affidavit from the plaintiff. The defendant accepts everything that's in the affidavit. That is the high watermark of the claim, and I'm in as good a position as a trial judge to assess the facts when they're presented in that fashion and they are not in dispute. He said the fact that the plaintiff had been included in previous wills was not a recognition of the existence of a moral duty. They had a good relationship, but that doesn't mean there's a moral duty. The plaintiff's real grievance was that he didn't get the farm and the cousin did. So the claim was dismissed. Now, that caused, as I've said in the paper, that caused a lot of excitement. As much excitement as you might expect a decision like that could cause. And then there was a sequence of applications which were considered by associate justices, and a lot of you will be familiar with these decisions. And I've referred to them in the judgment there. There's Wollensack and Leone at paragraph 22. That was a claim by a sister. The claim by the sister in circumstances where the deceased had provided her with some financial support back in around 1980 when her marriage failed. She had also provided some support around 1988, but the extent of the support was unclear. It was unclear whether any support at all had been provided in the last 20 years, and I think that's what the defendant honed in on. The Her Honour, Associate Justice Zammit, said, well, the evidence is equivocal. Nevertheless, the court's not satisfied that the claim should be dismissed. It strikes me, reading that judgment, as an extremely cautious decision, and the sort of decision that perhaps if the comments of Justice Neave were taken on board may have been decided differently. And I'd make the same comment in relation to a number of these judgments which follow. There's Story against Semmons. That was a granddaughter claim with no children, good salary, $150,000. You'll see the situation outlined at paragraph 25. Home worth $750,000, mortgage $235,000. She's aged 40. Unremarkable relationship with the grandparent. Now, that claim for summary judgment was dismissed, was unsuccessful as well. And the court, it's a very considered judgment, and referred to Petrucci and Fields and Berkelmans and Bullock, which are, you know, again, granddaughter claims. I think Berkelmans is a daughter, but interestingly, this one went on appeal before Justice Macaulay, and Justice Macaulay upheld the decision of the Associate Justice, and there's not a judgment, there are no written reasons, but I understand that Justice Macaulay said that such applications as Part 4s are particularly unsuited to summary judgment applications. The next one is Webb and Ryan, and Webb and Ryan is an interesting one because it's a claim by six plaintiffs, two parents and their four children, on the estate of the late business partner of the father. So it's not a family relationship, it's a friend and business partner. It's a claim by the parents and their children. The business partners had known each other since the 1960s. They'd worked together in the 70s, bought a business in the 90s, worked closely in the business. The kids worked in the business. The kids really looked up to the parent, the deceased, as a mentor and a friend and, I suppose, an uncle. The deceased died and they made this claim. Her Honour, Associate Justice Zammit, dealt with the application for summary judgment. She said that the claim did not sit comfortably with cases determined by the court since 1997 amendments. Sits at the very margin and so on, so making all the right noises for a positive outcome for the defendant in that case. However, the problem here was that the defendant had waited until all of the affidavit material had been served, 23 affidavits from the defendant, 9 from the plaintiff, and Her Honour said no. A summary judgment claim, a summary judgment application at that stage of proceedings is entirely inappropriate. It's a misuse of the summary judgment procedure. So she didn't really deal with the merits of the claim. So there's a lesson in that. If you're going to make an application, make it early. The matter went to trial before Justice Whelan, who dispatched the claim and dismissed it. And it said it fell well short of establishing a moral duty. Now, I'm running out of time. I've referred to a couple of other judgments, Colville and Edmonds, which is another failed application, which is a decision of Associate Justice Randall. And then there's Napolitano and State Trustees, and this is really a bookend with Jackson and Nunes, because Jackson and Nunes succeeded, this application in Napolitano succeeded. It was again a judgment of Associate Justice Mukhtar. It was again a claim by a nephew. This time the nephew, he was nephew by marriage, I should add. He got nothing under the will. He was a hopeless case. He was had psychological problems. I think he'd meddled in drugs. I've set out a fairly comprehensive summary of the case, and you can read that at your leisure. By way of conclusion, can I say make a couple of points? It appears that very little has changed with the new test. However, as I said a moment ago, I would, if you're running such an application, I would certainly make the court aware of the comments of Her Honour Justice of Appeal Neave. The two decisions of Associate Justice Mukhtar merit close scrutiny. They demonstrate that an application for summary judgment can succeed in this jurisdiction. The key, I think, to a successful application is very, very close scrutiny of the plaintiff's affidavit. Quite often you will get a claim made with only one affidavit. Sometimes when you dismantle the affidavit and put it all in chronological order, you'll find that there are extensive periods where the relationship, there is no reference at all to what happened. So if there's only one affidavit, look at it very, very closely. If the application is going to be made, make it early. Don't put on your own material. Make it as soon as possible. There may be circumstances where you would put on material to establish an incontrovertible fact, but certainly don't put on material that causes a factual dispute, because you won't succeed. Jones and Dunkell has a role to play. In Napolitano, the last case, His Honour pointed to the fact that the plaintiff's mother was in a position to give evidence about a lot of the factual matters in this case and had not done so. So if the plaintiff's mother wouldn't give evidence in his favour, that says a lot, but the rule in Jones and Dunkelk had a role to play there. And before you go rushing off to make an application for summary judgment, be aware of what I've described in the paper as decisions that are at the margins. Sinclair and Forsyth, a de facto case from, I think, 4 years ago, Court of Appeal judgment, Justice of Appeal Redlich said this case is at the margins. A lot of claims seem to get up which are, as I say, really at the margins. You look at them and think, surely that claim can't succeed. Well, quite often they do. So beware of, just remember, you can have a look through all of those judgments and find cases that are generally analogous, in at least in broad terms, and just beware that sometimes they do get up. But my last comment is take heart from the decision of Her Honour in Larkin and Borg, where a claim by a mistress earlier this year was dismissed by Her Honour, and it was quite a refreshing change. Thank you.